All right, so this is Tuesday...
December 11th.
And we're in the office of the Environmental Commissioner, and we're here with David Donnelly, Bruce Lurie, and...
Andrew Stewart.
And we're going to talk about the role of foundations in the environmental movement.
Really? So who wants to start? Anything?
The point that Bruce Lurie invented the genre of the modern environmental grant making, and so I certainly have lots to add on the deployment, implementation, campaigning, and strategy, or I hope to. And Andrew can certainly provide a lot of insights on how foundations work and think, and his strategizing around land use in Southern Ontario and other efforts. But the conversation really starts and ends with Bruce Lurie and his development of the sector. When I first started in 1987, environmental grant making was a mostly haphazard, ad hoc use of funds by people who often directed them towards their own pet projects. It's probably fair to say. There was very little coordination. And I think the money, by and large, wound up, in many cases, in the wrong places at the wrong time. Starting in around 1990 or so, Bruce will give you all the details, there was a bit of coordination, a little bit of effort into better researching the recipients, making the donations more strategic, and aligning priorities to get foundations to act in concert in many cases to make sure that the priorities were put in place in a way that would be much, much more effective. And I will say this, that Bruce was right at the center of doing all that. So I'm going to at least very temporarily turn it over to Bruce and Andrew.
Maybe a little background to broaden out. How many foundations are in play in Ontario, roughly? I know it varies a little bit, but there's a few. There are the bigger players. Ivy is with your foundation, and that's obviously a big player.
Yeah, I would say there are, let's say, around 20 probably players and maybe a half dozen big players.
Yeah.
And so Ivy Foundation, I guess my early days, right, for the first, I spent 10 years running the Laidlaw Foundation's environment program. So that was my introduction to funding environmental work, was through the Laidlaw Foundation. And I worked with a couple other foundations. But you could almost divide, I think, the way David's framing it. There really are, I think, a couple of phases. So the early phases, exactly. And I used to describe it a similar way, right? Foundations, basically, it would be families. Yours operates in some ways in a similar fashion, but so, I mean, not, I'm not, this sounds a little bit derogatory, but,
no, okay. yeah, totally the
same. Know, families sitting around a dinner table, you know, firing off grants because, you know, Uncle Willie's cousin is on the theater and, you know, Uncle Sally's niece is a ballerina, and so the grants would kind of go off out the door ad hoc with no sense of strategy or coordination and not always necessarily any research or investigation into is this the best use of money. I think there were always exceptions, and certainly there were some good grants made. I think it took quite a few years before the environment, as I'm sure as you've heard from all these organizations, sort of probably between 69 and 72 was the period that the first infrastructure started to appear. You know, Pollution Probe was created, and the NCC was created, and the Ministry of Environment was created, and it's kind of the core organizations that we think of were established. And so for a foundation, the foundations weren't sitting around, you know, with environmental programs wondering, gee, I wonder when there will be environmental groups we can fund, right? Yeah. So, environmental groups spring up, the issue springs up, issues become, again, all the big things, the Lake Erie being declared dead, or the Great Lakes declared dead, and the Cuyahoga River catching on fire, and acid rain, and all of the, the big iconic environmental challenges of the early 70s, I think, created the movement, and the foundations were slow, very slow, I think, to come into it, with a couple of exceptions. You know, as you mentioned, long before my time, the Ivy Foundation, which, in fact, this is the 65th anniversary of the Ivy Foundation, so we're one of the oldest foundations in the country, probably within the 10 oldest foundations in Canada. the Ivies, and you know, Mr. and Mrs. Ivy had always a passion for the environment, and it was it's a personal thing. And so, as you find with almost all foundations, their funding ultimately is from a personal passion. The Ivies, I mean, fortunately for the environmental community, starting with the parents and now into the next generation, all have a passion for the environment. So making that early grant in 1969, I think it was $25,000 to Pollution Probe to kind of get them going, was very, you know, remarkable in many ways. And then, as I said, the grant, they made $1 million to the Nature Conservancy in 1969, which, I mean, we don't make $1 million grants today.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's
today, it would still be a huge deal.
Yeah. 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 So it's extraordinary sense of need, extraordinary commitment and ability to recognize the importance and value. And to this day, there's still not only the foundation, but the entire Ivy family is making contributions, probably larger than the foundation's contributions, frankly, on a personal basis to the environment. So I think the Ivy Foundation has been there probably as one of the most consistent funders and largest funders of environment in Ontario. And then we started seeing others come in, and some in I would say, a significant way as well, like the Gordon Foundation and the Laidlaw Foundation. Metcalf, probably more recently, certainly the McLean Foundation. You guys have been making grants to the environment for years and years as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your cousin Patty's been hugely passionate and focused on these issues.
McLean was made grants to environmental defense back in late 80s, early 90s. They were one of the first early adopters of quite radical programs. So they funded, you funded the Inuit Nation and our campaign to stop Lolo flight training in Labrador, which was completely unheard of. I mean, this was crossing the Canadian military, crossing the Canadian establishment, aligning with a First Nations group in Labrador that were, you know, were the wards of the Newfoundland government. I was actually quite struck by how radical it was then to make that kind of foundation grant. You guys were the first to really come in. You know, so.
Do you recall from the early years stuff that you were doing or other things that people were doing?
I'm sort of here under false pretenses in a way, because I joined the board of McLean Foundation in 1989, and I know the least in a way. Like, my older brother Tim Stewart, who you may know, is very knowledgeable and has been a committed environmentalist for many years. He should really be here instead of me, but I'll do my best. I guess the McLean Foundation, it's been around since 1945, and it started under not my grandfather's leadership, but really under his children's leadership. My mother, her brother Bill McLean, and Mary Stewart, my aunt, who's dead, and so is Bill. Mary is based in Vancouver, so they started funding environmental work in BC, I guess, in the 70s. And in Ontario, my mother was on the board of the FON, so she got involved that way. And a lot of the early grants were this very much ad hoc kind of grants for land acquisition, really, by the Nature Conservancy and even the FON, the Nature Reserves Committee of the FON. So it would have started off in a very, you know, non-controversial, non-political level with land grant acquisitions, starting in the probably late 60s.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point. I think the early role of foundations, I mean, it took a lot. Even, you know, when I started, most foundations were still very conservative and very unwilling to kind of rock the boat or fund anyone that was perceived to be radical. And so,
somehow the likes of you squeezed in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'll credit the Laidlaw Foundation really for not having that view at all, you know, and getting me involved initially. But if you look at who was funded, it really was the Nature Conservancy and World Wildlife Fund and the Federation of Ontario Naturalists. And so it was very much it wasn't environmental issues, it was conservation and naturalists that really got the bulk of the money.
And advocacy was taboo.
Yep.
So my job, I was executive director of environmental defense, which in those days was called the Canadian Environmental Defense Fund, or CEDF. My job was to assist citizens groups with environmental assessments or court challenges in remote communities who were trying to stop mega projects, by and large. Most of our cases in those days were outside of Ontario. we were started as an adjunct to the Kinney-Barmer Law Association as kind of its fundraising arm. And then John Swagan, who was on the original board, I think, of CBEDF, it became apparent that we needed to separate. So we did, and we sort of went off and would take care of the legal cases outside of Ontario, and CELA would represent a lot of the citizens groups inside Ontario, things like environmental assessments and so on and so forth. So my job originally was to go around and try and raise money from private individuals, but also from foundations, to do this newfangled thing, which was advocacy, like a U.S.-style advocacy group like Environmental Defense or Fund or the National Resource Defense Council, NRDC. And it was a little bit unheard of in Canada. It wasn't sort of the way we did things. We didn't really fund citizens groups who would then go before, you know, intervener funding who would go before these panels and object, or even more rarely and strangely go to court to try and stop projects. So I can remember being turned down by just about everybody in the initial few years at CEDF, particularly with foundations, when we would pitch this idea of advocacy supporting citizens. It wasn't advocacy to try and stop projects or to protest projects, anything else. It was to provide them a little bit of money for a lawyer or an expert or an engineer so they could participate in, say, for example, environmental assessment hearing, federal environmental assessment, where the government was calling people in to participate but not giving them any money or resources to participate on an equal footing. So I can remember our original suite of cases were things like military low-level flight training in Labrador that affected the Inuit Nation. There was a proposal to put in a NATO tactical weapons training facility that would have had bombing courses out over the North Atlantic that would have affected whale migration routes and overland with live ammunition. CEDF was one of the few advocacy organizations in the entire country to support the Newfoundland Inshore Fishermen's Association, who opposed the issuance of a total allowable catch for northern cod in 1989 and 1990. And they, in fact, brought a federal court challenge seeking a mandamus to stop the issuance of the TAC for cod in, I think it was 1990. They were unsuccessful, and the government issued the TAC. They went out, basically fished almost the last cod, and, you know, the cod have never come back. But that was part of our program at ED, and we try to raise money to help these fishermen. And it was really tough going, because it wasn't that the cases weren't compelling, they were. It's that people just did not fund that kind of advocacy in those days.
Yeah, and that's actually, I was, that's right about the time I came on the Environmental Defense Board. And I haven't thought about that recently, but I used to say to people, use that as an example. Here was a little organization trying to point out to people that if the government did what they were about to do, it would destroy the cod fishery in Atlantic Canada. And nobody listened. We raised not a cent. Nothing happened. The government ignored us. And it ended up being, what was it, like a $5 billion bailout for the local fishermen and the economy? Like, it's... Imagine if we just raised a few hundred thousand dollars. You know, it could have been a massive difference. So,
well, we did raise a few tens of thousands of dollars, Bruce. So my Christmas bonus that year was tied specifically to fundraising. God stop it.
No, I'm largely to blame. I was a chair of the freaking fisheries committee.
And when was that exactly?
Oh, me and my years. Well, it was the year before the cod action collapsed.
1991.
So I was going to say, 1992.
God, yeah, so great. 20 years.
Between 90 to 92, exactly, yeah. And
well, we actually had some of the guys come down. The City of Toronto Council passed a resolution calling for a moratorium on cod fishing. You know, we were surprisingly active. I mean, people did know that this was happening. It was a slow-motion car crash. Mm. People knew it was coming.
Yeah.
But no one explained that there are no cod in the City of Toronto.
Yeah, right.
Well, there are no sharks either.
Exactly.
You know, the only slight sort of addendum to that I'd make is that the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline inquiry in 1977, is that what it was? I think had an effect. You know, one of the people on our board is Ted Chamberlain. Mm. Who has been on for 30 years, and he was a participant in that pipeline inquiry, representing or talking about First Nations interests. And, you know, at that time, I think, at least, you know, it was long before my time, but I think on the McLean Foundation, we certainly were supporting for a long time, starting in the 70s, Canadian Arctic Resources Committee, CARC. And yeah. I think that might have come out of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline.
Yeah, I think you're right. In fact, that attracted, interestingly, a fair bit of foundation money. I mean, Gordon Foundation had their whole Arctic program. EGLB was a big funder of CARC. We were funding them at the Laidlaw Foundation. Yeah, there was a real... I think there was some real draw that people had to seeing the Arctic as a threatened ecosystem and something really important and unique in Canada. And
Yeah,
foundations were unusually attached to that issue. I bet you're right. It's the Berger Inquiry was a big... that was a cornerstone of Canadian environmental...
And it drew a lot of attention, probably for most people, for the very first time to the Canada's Arctic.
Yeah.
But perversely, I'll jump in here, and I'll be a little bit of a devil's advocate here. Perversely, as attached as the foundations were to issues like creating national parks, fighting for the Arctic, looking at these sort of charismatic megafauna, they were surprisingly detached in these early sort of years from anything having to do with Southern Ontario, which is where most of them are based. So there was very little advocacy going on around the loss of farmland, for example. You know, highway building was rampant, nobody was taking on. The incredible loss of biodiversity and species in this area.
Well, it was just the land acquisition piece. That's how people were addressing it, right?
Yeah.
Buy land, like fund NCC, fund Ontario Nature, buy land. It wasn't...
But that was not...
But no one was addressing the core problems. They were just...
In hindsight, I think it's fair to say that was an ineffective way of saving the environment.
Except for the establishment of the Niagara Escarpment Commission early on. I mean, somebody like Lynn McMillan was very influential, at least with people like my mother. Like, they were friends, and she had a big effect on influencing people on the Niagara Escarpment in particular, but on loss of countryside,
loss of
to
habitat,
urban sprawal and deforestation, I think.
In fact, the Ivy's early funding was all exclusive to southwestern Ontario, right? So Carolinian Canada was their big thing, and funding, I think they funded things that were, you know, opposing loss of farmland, preserving existing green spaces, some of the very early, I think, understanding of an ecosystem. So that was all before my time, but the Ivies were, you know, regionally focused on southwestern Ontario and were hugely behind, anyone recall, but World Wildlife Fund had a Carolinian, they created an organization actually, started as a program called Carolinian Canada, which spun off to an organization, I think,
still
called
exists.
Carolinian Canada.
Yeah, still there.
and that was largely the Ivy Foundation funding that through World Wildlife Fund, so, which I hadn't thought of, but very focused on southwestern Ontario, not GTA stuff.
So with that, along comes this lure guy, looked Ivy in 1992.
Yeah, Laidlaw in 92.
That's what I got, Ivy in 2002.
Yeah, and, it's funny because I still, exactly as Dave was saying, I remember starting out, I don't even think I knew what a foundation was. And, in fact, it was Paul Muldoon that said to me, I had started up a little environmental consulting company, which is now, is the precursor to Summerhill Group, and I was doing consulting work for Pollution Probe. And Paul Muldoon said to me, there's this little, you know, fax came in saying the Laidlaw Foundation's looking for somebody to run their environment program. You should apply for it. And I said, oh, cool, great. Not having a clue what a foundation was. Anyway, so that's how I ended up at the Laidlaw Foundation and spent 10 years. And so the first 4 years of that, they had a program on Great Lakes conservation. And it had a great little group with... what's his name from Waterloo?
John Jackson.
John later on and Phil later on in the early days. The professor at
George Francis.
Yeah, George Francis was sort of the chair of the committee and the kind of the intellectual spirit of the program. And what a just spectacular guy. And he was sort of my early introduction to somebody that was, you know, kind of smart, but an activist at heart and a professor, and he clearly convinced the Laidlaw Foundation that this was an issue we should work on, and I just thought he was one of the most marvelous people. So so I was there just sort of running their Great Lakes Conservation Program, which you know, was funding Pollution Probe and funding Great Lakes United and a lot of work working collaboratively with a lot of the American foundations. And that's when, you know, it sort of struck me, well, there's all these foundations out there, but no one actually talks to each other. No one knows who each other are. I thought, well, this is sort of strange. And I remember Nathan saying to me, you should go. There's this organization that's just, you know, been set up called the Environmental Grantmakers Association. You should check out their annual meeting. So I went to this first Environmental Grantmakers Association meeting in Washington State. And so I went from, gee, I went like, what are these foundation things, to, oh, I guess I'm like the only one in Canada doing this, to a meeting with 100 people from Ford and Rockefeller and all these like just extraordinary, fun, energetic, smart people all working on these issues. And I thought, holy mackerel, it was like just blew me away. It was so, so influential for me. And then I came back and within a couple of years thought, well, we should create our own thing. So that's when we started the Canadian Environmental Grantmakers Network. And I remember saying to someone at the time, well, this will be great, but we'll only ever have 12 members. Because I really thought that's how big the sector was in Canada. And here we are 15 years later, and there are 65 members of the Canadian Environmental Grantmakers Network, which gives you a sense now of the scope in Canada. And it's become just a fantastic little organization. And then after a few years of focusing on Great Lakes, we decided to shift the program focus, and that's where, you know, I worked with the foundation to develop the Children's Environmental Health Program. And that's what, for me, was very exciting, because I was personally really attached to those issues, and that's what led us into, you know, bringing the health issues to the coal plant. Which, remember having those debates with you in the early days, getting the Ontario Medical Association involved, making some of the first grants to CAPE to get CAPE going, Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, funding the Alan Abelson's, and he's the environment group at the other doctors group in Ontario. And that was where I think the foundation was able to seed some really great stuff. And being able to work through those early years with Jack Gibbons and creating the coal shutdown campaign, which I would say is probably one of the great environmental successes ever, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
A legislated closure of all the coal-fired power plants. And I'm not sure how many people really realize how Jack Gibbons was just single-handedly focused on that. And then when we got the OMA involved, so we created the... in fact, it was, you know, really... through our work at the Laidlaw Foundation, where we created the position of Environment Director at the Ontario Medical Association, mm-hmm. and agreed to pay the full salary of the director for 3 years on the condition that the OMA would make it a permanent job. And so it was a very deliberative strategy to bring health into environmental issues, which then also got me working on toxics issues. I would say in those early days at the Laidlaw Foundation, we seeded quite a few things. In fact, it was also being in the States and coming back and realizing that they had the Institute for Conservation Leadership and another group called the Environmental Support Center. And I'm thinking, well, how come in Canada we don't have anything? There are no agencies that are actually serving the environmental community. So I spent a couple of years talking to people and trying to figure out what to do, and then ended up setting up the Sustainability Network and hiring Paul Labellis. And Paul actually had an office at the Laidlaw Foundation. And so it was really that early... you know, incubation of Sustainability Network was all through the initially through the, you know, the Laidlaw Foundation, and then we were able to convince Trillium Foundation to be big supporters, and in the States we got Joyce Foundation money and Mott Foundation money, and so it was very Ontario focused. But the whole notion was that we didn't have an organization in Canada to provide basic leadership and management training for environmental nonprofits. And they just had their 15th anniversary the other day. So I think, you know, I feel very fortunate, but through those opportunities and having the Laidlaw Foundation, you know, very supportive, I think we got some really fun stuff off the ground. Now, looking back 15 years, they're still viable, important organizations. Hmm. But foundations play, both Sustainability Network and CEGN are... well, CGN is the Association of Foundations, but Sustainability Network survives exclusively off of foundation funding, so it's a great kind of success story of foundations recognizing the value of that organization.
Mm.